This is a podcast from the AHRC ICT Methods Network at www.methodsnetwork.ac.uk.
The talk I'm doing today is based on a chapter in a book I've just finished writing, which is called Using Colpra for Discourse Analysis. And at the moment, this is still a very fairly underused way of carrying out discourse analysis. And the point of my book is to explore how we can effectively use Colpra to do this, and also to look at any potential problems which may arise and how these problems can be dealt with. And the book looks at a variety of different types of corpus-based techniques, like collocation and concordances and tagging, and I use a range of different types of corpora in each chapter. But for the purpose of this talk, I want to just focus on one chapter and one corpus, which contains a number of transcripts of debates on fox hunting, which took place in the House of Commons in the UK in 2002. I've chosen to look at fox hunting. It's something that I'm sort of personally interested in, which is probably irrelevant, but it's one of the more recent high-profile debates in the UK Parliament in recent years. There have been numerous attempts to ban or regulate fox hunting across the century, and it's been described by the British media as one of the most divisive issues among the population. Tony Blair's Labour Party manifesto in 1997 promised a free vote in Parliament on whether hunting with hounds should be banned. And in July 1999, he announced he would make fox hunting illegal and before the next general election, if possible. And the ban was implemented in February of this year, I think. So what I was interested in was the ways that fox hunting was talked about by the people who were responsible for whether this ban was carried out or not. I was interested in the different discourses of fox hunting that were accessed by different speakers in the debate, and depending whether they were arguing for the ban or against it. So were there any differences in the language use on these two sides of the debate, and were these language differences linked to some sort of rhetorical strategy or sort of way of talking about discourses of fox hunting? And parliamentary language is of obvious interest to people who are interested in CDA or discourse analysis. This sort of language can potentially affect decisions about laws which can have very immediate consequences for large numbers of people. So the debates I used have been transcribed and placed online at the Houses of Parliament website. And although other researchers have found that there are sometimes transcription issues with these transcripts to do with making the language in the debate more legible, on the whole, they're reasonably accurate transcriptions of what took place. A good deal of the speech in these debates consists of sort of pre-written speeches, and speakers can generally talk for quite a long time without being interrupted, again suggesting some sort of pre-prepared element to their speech. So I looked at three debates altogether on fox hunting, and in all cases there were a vote that took place afterwards and people voted whether to keep or ban fox hunting, although the majority always voted to ban hunting. And I could have looked maybe at more debates spanning a wider range of time. I could have also looked at debates that took place in the House of Lords, but these would have introduced additional factors into my analysis, so I thought I'd just try to keep it as simple as possible. So these debates amounted to about 130,000 words, about the size of a large PhD thesis with lots of appendices. And I used concordance package Wordsmith tools to carry out this corpus-based analysis of the data. And there are lots of things you can do with Wordsmith. I only want to go through some of the various stages of my analysis and point out some of the more interesting findings. And one of the aspects of the corpus then I was very interested in was this idea that some people argued for, some people argued against fox hunting. And this suggests one area where there may be lexical differences. So first I put all of the speech, I sort of singled it out, the people who argued against hunting into one file, all the speech of people who argued for hunting into another file. And there were about 71,000 words people were wanting to ban hunting, 58,000 words for the pro-hunt speech. I then used Wordsmith to derive frequency lists for these sort of sub-corpora of the two sides of the debate, and then I compared them against each other using the log likelihood statistic to get a list of words which occurred significantly more often on one side of the debate in comparison to the other side of the debate. Now, this list of keywords won't necessarily reveal very frequent words to us, but what instead it gives us is a measure of saliency, words which are statistically more frequent on one side of the debate when compared against the other. And that's on the table on the first page of the handout, that big table there. And I've split this into two lists, actually, to show which words were key for each side of the debate. So on to the analysis. Well, looking at these keywords by themselves, they don't really tell us that much about discourses of fox hunting, which was what I was interested in. But hopefully, if we start to examine them in more detail, we should get an idea of trying to find out why they occurred, and that should tell us something about the more important aspects of language use in the corpus. I don't have time to talk about all of them there are lots there, but I do want to show a few examples of how we can examine them to uncover discourses in language use. How about the first word on the table, the word criminal? This is a word which reflects one of the strongest differences between the two sides of the debate. And the keywords themselves, they tell us very little. What we have to do is ask why these words appeared in the list, and although we can start to form hypotheses at this stage, we need to carry out a more detailed analysis of each keyword, for example, by looking at how they occur in context. So to do this, over the page, I carried out a concordance of the word criminal, getting a list of all of the cases of its uses and the context that they appear in. That's the concordance table there. It's only 14 lines. This is only the first 14 lines from the debate. And just looking down this quite short concordance, though, you can start to see some patterns and repetitions of language use here. On the right-hand side of the table, the one after criminal, we've got things like criminal law, that appears 5 times, criminal sanctions appears 4 times, criminal act, criminal offence. Then on the left-hand side of the table, we've got invoke, invocation, imposing occurs 2 times there, and various forms of the verb to make also appear, as in to make something criminal. And what seems clear from this table is that the pro hunters, who use this word more often, are using a strategy framing the proposed fox hunting ban as criminalising or making criminal people, and that they are very much against this. So the table also has words like wrong and terrible in it. What about some of the other keywords? Well, what was interesting is when I started to go down the initial list of keywords and do concordances like this for each word, I started to see similarities in certain keywords. I started to be able to find I could group them together because they were sort of reinforcing each other. They were contributing to a sort of overarching discourse. So words like sanctions, offence, imposing, illiberal, they all worked in a very similar way to criminal. They were referring to these sort of civil rights issues to do with fox hunting. And I've got a concordance for liberal there, which shows sort of a similar sort of thing to criminal. Another related discourse that the pro-hunters seem to be drawing on is found when I looked at words like people, fellow citizens, Britain, and freedom. And these words sort of taken together were sort of referencing a kind of nationalistic discourse, saying that Britain's a good country and it's a place where people are free to do what they want to do. References to the people of Britain and my fellow citizens or our fellow citizens were used quite a lot there. There was also the phrase unjustifiable restrictions on individual freedom, which occurred quite a few times. So these are sort of repetitive patterns that are indicative of discourses. The more times we hear these sorts of phrases again and again, the stronger, the greater the incremental effect of discourse, the greater the power that these ideas are starting to have in the debate. I think it's interesting that this sort of pro-hunting discourse therefore works on sort of two levels at the same time. At one level, there's a sort of sense of national identity, sort of everybody belonging to the same group. But then there's also talking about rights of the individual, using both arguments, the individual and the sort of national identity, to allow fox hunting to continue. And I think that's quite a kind of powerful way of arguing. So I looked at some other keywords like this as well, I looked at all of them, in fact, to try to get some idea. The main sorts of discourses in this debate. But that's not the end of the story. So far, my analysis has been very much based around the idea that there are two sides to a debate and that there are going to be differences in language on each side. But there are a number of potential problems with this perspective. In focusing on difference, what we may be doing is actually exaggerating it. We may be ignoring possible similarities between the two sides, which may be just as important. The fact that certain words don't occur as keywords may be just as important as the words which do occur. And this is one of the biggest potential problems, I think, for corpus linguistics and other methodologies that use data, for that matter, it's far more difficult to analyse absence or something that isn't there, because we may not be aware of what's actually not there in the first place. And one thing that I decided to do then before I started this analysis is that I tried to think about the sorts of possible words that might appear in the keywords list. I sort of formed my own hypotheses. I looked at some of the transcripts of the data myself, and I hypothesised that people who wanted to ban hunting would maybe, they would use a kind of moral discourse. They'd talk about cruelty to animals, that sort of thing, quite a lot. And that various words connected to cruelty would therefore come up as being key. But looking back on the first page of that list of anti-hunting keywords, there's only one word which actually fit into my moral discourse hypothesis, and that's the word barbaric, which is on the first page at line 33. And in all cases of this word, it's used by people who wanted to ban hunting to talk about it as being barbaric. But one word I was expecting to come up, or set of words, were words like cruelty, cruel, that sort of thing. But cruelty didn't occur as a keyword for people who wanted to ban hunting. And looking at overall frequencies on each side of the debate, it occurred 124 times for people who wanted to ban hunting, 106 times for people who wanted to keep hunting. And taking into account sort of relative sizes of these two subcorpora, what we find is actually the people who want to keep hunting proportionally talk about cruelty more than the people who want to ban hunting. And this went completely against my initial hypothesis that people who want to ban hunting would talk about cruelty more. So something interesting is happening with the word cruelty here, which I'll try to explain in a minute. But other than deciding in advance that I was going to look for this word and sort of examine it, how can we get Wordsmith or the keywords mechanism to sort of show it up as being important? Well, for a case like cruelty, it's clearly an important, it's a frequent word on both sides of the debate. And one way to reveal this would be to carry out another keywords comparison, to join the whole corpus of debates back together into one big corpus, and then compare that to a completely different corpus, a reference corpus. And this allows us to see which words occur significantly across the whole debate. So to do this, I used the million word FLOB corpus of modern British English. That's the Freiburg, Lancaster, Oslo, Bergen corpus, to give it its full title. And again, the procedure was the same as before. I ended up with two sets of keywords again. These are on the handout there over the page. The words in the first column there are words which were key in the fox hunting debates when compared to FLOB. The last column are the negative keywords, words which occurred less often than we would expect in the fox hunting debates when compared to general British English. So what does this tell us? Well, some of these keywords are words we've already seen. They happen just to be key because they occurred more often in one side of the debate quite a lot, so they were very frequent. But what we do have here is the word cruelty as a keyword at line 14. It's not a word which we've encountered so far via Wordsmith, yet Wordsmith is telling us that it is an important word across the whole debate. It's worth looking at. So then, why do both sides of this debate refer to cruelty so much? Are there any differences in the way that they use this word? And again, it's a good idea to look at concordances from the respective sides of the debate. And I've put a couple of sample concordances there underneath that table, which illustrate some of the main uses and how these relate to discourse. So, with the anti-hunt speakers, cruelty tended to occur next to or near a set of words like ban, eradicate, end, root out, tackle, prevent, unnecessary. And I've put those words there in bold. They also tended to use the word cruelty in a way which sort of assumed it actually existed. It wasn't something which was up for question or debate. So a longer example, the expanded line would be, the underlying purpose of the bill is to ban all cruelty associated with hunting with dogs. In cases like this, cruelty is presented as a given, it's a fact. But with pro-hunt speakers, we get a different picture. Here the word cruelty tends to be used next to or near words like define, tests, definition, perceived, and evidence. And the overall theme here is to question this definition of cruelty, to problematise its use in the bill. So to suggest maybe that cruelty doesn't actually exist at all in relation to fox hunting. So one pro-hunt speaker says, cruelty is subjective and comparative. The bill entirely fails adequately to define cruelty. And looking closer at the pro-hunter uses of cruelty, I found that one speaker in particular used the term very often, and he used it all in one speech. And I put that speech over the page on the handout, because I think it's one of the most interesting speeches in the corpus to analyse. It's quite an unusual speech. There's something quite almost poetic about it, in fact. I've put his five uses of cruelty there in bold. There's a lot of rhetorical repetition in this speech. Repetition of the word cruelty. The word cruel also appears twice. The phrase for our pleasure is repeated twice there. The association between cruelty and pleasure, I think, is quite interesting too. And these sorts of repetitions are quite powerful, sort of rhetorically. And David Crystal notes how repeated sequences like this tend to provide a sense of climax for audiences. And then we've got this question at the end, but the question is, how cruel is it? Bringing us back to this idea of presenting a resistant discourse of fox hunting, getting people to reconsider definitions of the word cruelty. So this concept of cruelty, therefore, is one of the key points in the debate. Both sides are using this word, both sides trying to claim ownership for the word, trying to make it work for them. And though I'd assumed that the word cruelty would therefore only be used by people who wanted to ban hunting, the pro-hunters have sort of taken control of this word in a way, and to an extent, to present their own resistant discourse around fox hunting. And we could say that rhetorically this is quite an effective strategy. They're presenting an argument, but they're using the language of their opponents. But we could also maybe argue that at the same time, in having to state their resistant discourse, a byproduct of this is that they're having to restate the anti-hunting discourse at the same time, even if they're disagreeing with it. So they're giving time to their opponents as well. Okay, so the final aspect of the analysis I want to look at before I stop is to go beyond the lexical level of keywords to consider the use of something called key categories. And this is something which I think Dawn is going to talk about after me later on in more detail. And as I've already shown, some of the keywords I've looked at already made sense to be grouped together because they contributed to the same sort of discourse, words like criminal, imposing, illiberal, offence. But when I did this sort of grouping of keywords, it was quite impressionistic. I had to do it by hand. It was quite sort of subjective process, and people may have disagreed with what I'd found. Another more rigorous way of grouping words is to semantically tag the corpus first, assigning a sort of semantic tag to each word. So, for example, words like big, large, massive, huge, etc., would all sort of receive the same semantic tag for the measurement of something big. And the advantage of this sort of technique is that these words, big, large, etc., may only occur once or twice sort of individually in a corpus. But if you take the whole group of semantic words for largeness together, that group may be flagged up as a key category when compared to something else. So I used something called W-matrix to semantically tag the corpus, and I ran it through the keywords program again, with this time with the aim looking at which semantic tags would be flagged up as key on each side of the debate. Again, I'm comparing the pro-hunt speech to the anti-hunt speech. I don't have time to talk about all the semantic categories then that came out as key, but I do want to mention a couple of the more interesting ones here before I finish. So first of all, in the pro-hunt speeches, two semantic sets of words which occurred significantly more often were words which referenced the concept for sensible and words which referenced the concept for ethics. Looking at the sensible category first, and I've put a small sample concordance of these words here. These are words like sensible, reasonable, rational, as well as the opposite, words like ridiculous and absurd. And the concordance analysis here suggests that the pro-hunters are using the strategy to present themselves as being sensible, rational, reasonable, and their opponents as being ridiculous, illogical, and absurd. And this seems like quite an obvious thing to do, really, if you're having an argument or a debate. One of the features of hegemonic discourses is that they're often reiterated as common sense ways of thinking. So this is quite a powerful and quite a usual rhetorical strategy. But one thing we may want to ask then is, if that's the case, why didn't the anti-hunt speakers do the same thing? Why didn't they say that their position was sensible as well and their opponents were absurd and ridiculous? Another thing that the pro-hunters did was that they used more terms relating to ethics than the people who were against hunting. They used words like morality, ethical, moral, humane, rights, noble, fair, etc. And it seems that what they were doing was arguing their position from a much more explicitly ethical position than the anti-hunters, which again I found quite surprising, because I thought that the cruelty to animals argument would be the most obvious ethical stance to take. But when we look at the pro-hunt uses of these ethical terms, again we find a similar pattern to when we looked at the use of their word cruelty. What they're doing here is they're questioning the absolutist ethical standpoint of the anti-hunt protesters, trying to problematise or complicate this notion of ethics. So maybe the people who want to ban hunting don't really need to refer to ethics that much. It's quite an obvious stance for them to take. So ironically, what we're finding is all the references to ethics are coming from their opponents, who are trying to subvert this obvious argument, make it work in their favour instead. What about the other side of the debate? Well, one interesting category which came up here, people who wanted to ban hunting, were a set of words relating to strength or toughness. This is over the page. You've got words like strong and tough, robust, strengthen, as well as the opposite, words like weak and weakness. And the concordance suggests here that what they're doing is a sort of alternative rhetorical strategy. They're arguing that their position is a strong one, and the bill is strong, and that the position of their opponents is weak. So they're not concerned with talking about ethics so much, or saying that they were sensible and their opponents were ridiculous. So what I found then is we've got two different but related strategies of arguing a position, one in terms of what's sensible and stupid, and another in terms of what's strong or weak. And I'm not really sure why the two sides of the debate decided to do this, whether it was a sort of planned strategy or whether it was just something which to do with the way that they spoke. So it sort of evolved in some way. I don't really know why they did that. I'd be interested in hearing any of your hypotheses on why you think there was this sort of strange rhetorical split between the two. Okay, so maybe this is a good place to conclude. What have we found? Well, first, keywords are a very potential, useful way of drawing our attention to salient aspects of a text or corpus. But alone, keywords don't really tell us very much. It's only by carrying out more detailed qualitative analyses of them, by looking at their concordances and possibly things like collocations or the phrases that they appear in over and over again, that we can begin to explain why they've actually appeared in this list, what's happening with them. It's often the case that quite dissimilar keywords can be used for similar purposes. But again, it's only with further explorations that we can start to find this out. We also need to be aware that keywords can make us over-focus on difference and what's present. And sometimes what's similar or what's absent, what's not there, can be just as interesting, though that's harder for us to find. So therefore, it's maybe useful to consider a range of perspectives when we do a keywords type analysis. For example, introducing a third corpus into the equation, as we did with the FLOB corpus there. And also, it often makes sense to go beyond the lexical level when considering the concept of keyness. Looking at key semantic categories, or even, say, key grammatical categories, can also help to reveal some of the more important aspects of the corpus, which would have been overlooked if we just stuck at the lexical level and looked at single words alone. Okay, that's all I have to say. Thank you.